Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Gather 100 Americans at random, and 19 or 20 will have a disability. Half of those a problem significant enough to restrict mobility or daily life. For much of our history, federal law failed to protect the civil rights of people with disabilities, meaning a significant number of disabled people were effectively unable to find work or decent housing, or to take for granted the ability to visit stores, restaurants, even government buildings. The Americans with Disabilities Act, passed 25 years ago this week, has not entirely leveled the playing field. But as my guests will discuss, it catalyzed not only a change in laws and facilities, but a new way of thinking about how disabled people belong in and contribute to society. Leonard J. Davis is Distinguished Professor of Liberal Arts in the Departments of Disability Studies and English at the University of Illinois at Chicago. His new book is called Enabling Acts, the hidden story of how the Americans with Disabilities Act gave the largest U.S. minority its rights. Leonard, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
I think a lot of people might not think that people with disabilities are the largest U.S. minority. People aren't aware.
I think that's certainly true, and whenever I say that, I think there's usually a large reaction. But if you do the numbers and you consider disability to be part of an identity group, and we could talk about that, then for sure people with disabilities make up the largest minority in the United States. And we could also talk about the fact that they're also the poorest minority.
And of course, disability is not something that necessarily starts in childhood. A lot of us who are walking around today and can't imagine ourselves identifying with this group will someday find ourselves with a significant disability.
That's right. And that in itself leads to a whole series of interesting questions. I mean, first of all, I think it's about 50% of people over 65 have a disability, which is a pretty hefty number. If we all want to live longer than 65, then many of us will have various kinds of disabilities. And part of the issue is to think it through about what it means to have a disability and what it means to be a person with a disability. For a lot of people, it's nightmarish, the thought. And I think that's part of the, we can talk about that, but that's part of the nature of the discrimination, is that disability is the identity group that nobody wants to identify with. And but, you know, for a majority of people do get disabilities after birth. They're acquired. And it's actually, once you look at it sort of through the proper lens, it's part of life. There's a great expression, which is to call everybody temporarily able rather than calling people disabled, because we go through life and at various points in our lives we're abled and other points we're not abled or not so abled. And it's people tend to think of disability more like pregnancy, like you're either you're pregnant or you're not. But in fact, there's a whole range of there's a continua of human physiology, mental conditions, and so on that one inevitably sees among a group of people. And to just to sort of say like, well, that's them, and then we're over here, the normal people, that creates a lot of problems.
Is it fair to say that the lack of legislation before the ADA effectively kept many disabled people like out of public view?
Well, I don't know. Yes, absolutely. If you think about it, if you go back to sort of the bad old days when there was virtually no legislation, it would mean that, for example, if you were a wheelchair user, you know, that seems like something now that you can integrate yourself pretty well in society. But if you have to imagine a world with no curb cuts, no ramps, no public transportation that you could use. So if you had pretty much two choices. Either you lived at home with your family who took care of you, if you were lucky enough, or you were institutionalized. But to do the things that ordinary people do, to, you know, get up in the morning, get ready for work, go out to work, all of those things were virtually impossible because the world was set up to be full of barriers for people with disabilities.
You were raised by two deaf parents before the ADA existed. Can you tell us a little bit about how their lives and opportunities were limited by the lack of legal protections for their rights?
Sure. My parents were both profoundly deaf. the first thing that happened to them, aside from being deaf, was that they were put in schools for the deaf, for deaf children. And in those schools, the you weren't trained to be doctors and lawyers and, you know, business executives. You were trained in a very narrow range of things, shoemakers, not to say those aren't bad professions, but you there was no possibility for upward mobility. You were trained in the trades. And so that was one strong set of limitations. And my parents both went to school only through sixth grade, I think, or seventh grade. They both were tailors or alteration hands. My mother was an alteration hand in a department store in New York. So that's one thing. But then just the ordinary parts of life. For example, if somebody wanted to visit us, they would have to send a postcard to my mother or father, who would then say, yeah, we'll be home this date. Why don't you come back and send a postcard back? The person would show up at our front door, which was in an apartment building, and would try to ring the doorbell. But of course, my parents couldn't hear the doorbell, and they had a totally Rube Goldberg kind of setup, which supposed to set off a light so that they could see that someone was at the door. But not, you know, 50% of the time, it didn't work. So that person might have arranged a week in advance to visit my parents and wouldn't be able to get in and talk to them. If they went to a doctor, if they went to the hospital, if they went to religious services, they wouldn't understand anything. There were no interpreters. There was no captioning on TV. So I and many of the children of deaf parents would have to paraphrase what was going on. I know some kids who sat under the TV set, and while the parents watched the TV, the kid would tell them in sign language what the dialogue was. So it was a world that was designed to be exclusionary, and the only place that they were at home and what was really the deaf clubs which existed in those eras.
Did your parents think of themselves as disabled?
No, and in fact, that kind of raises an interesting issue because a lot of deaf people, even today, don't consider themselves disabled. The current thinking is from among many people who are deaf is that they are a linguistic minority. And that the problem is they can do everything. The problem is that there are people around them who don't or refuse to learn sign language. But my parents never considered themselves disabled. And my father used to say, I mean, his phrase was, "We're deaf. That's all. Nothing. We're the same as everybody else. We're just deaf." And in fact, I would say my father was a very good artist, and also was a world-class race walker. So he was a talented man. He just didn't get to realize those talents the way that somebody else might have.
All right, so let's talk about the first nationwide protections of any kind for people with disabilities. These came about in the early 1970s, but they were relatively limited.
Well, there were a series of laws which began to establish things. A lot of them were related to rehabilitation, especially of Vietnam vets coming back from the war. And sort of the hallmark piece of legislation was the Rehab Act in 1972. And that act had within it a tiny tweet-length section called Section 504. And no one, by the way, is actually sure how that got in there. Certainly none of the legislators, I don't think, were aware of its existence. But that Section 504 became the basis for giving civil rights to people with disabilities. And then there was a series of regulations that had to be written up because any law just doesn't go into effect. There are regulations that go with it. And the regulatory process, which was initially under the Nixon administration, was kind of dragged out because Nixon wasn't a huge fan of the legislation. When Carter took over, the regulations still were not finished, and there was some doubt about whether they would go in the right direction. And that led to a nationwide activism on the part of people with disabilities that really almost, I would say, started the disability activist movement. And it culminated in a sit-in in the HEW office in San Francisco for, I think, 28 or 29 days. It was the longest occupation of a federal building in the U.S. history. And they had tremendous support, not only among ordinary citizens, but I think the Black Panthers were supporting them. It was a big political thing, and it forced Secretary Califano at the time to finally sign the regulations. And there, you know, so that was definitely a watershed moment in the history of people with disabilities.
There were, of course, sort of a patchwork of laws in some states. They were different everywhere you went, that offered some protections. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, the people who have vision limitations or hearing limitations or mobility limitations may not appear to have the same set of needs. Did groups at first sort of lobby with those that had similar disabilities in mind? And what did it take for people to come together and say, let's all talk about what all of us need as a collective group?
Yeah, most certainly there was. It's not obvious, I would say, that people with disabilities are one group. Mm-hmm. I mean, that took a little bit of evolution for people with disabilities to say, like, hey, we're a group just like African Americans and women and gays and lesbians. So initially, yes, there are special organizations, and many of these organizations, by the way, were really run by people without disabilities. But they each lobbied for things that they wanted. And I would say that it was the 504 demonstrations and pushes that that led to a more collective sense that something larger needed to be done, that, you know, each little group arguing for its rights was much less effective than thinking of people with disabilities as an entire group. And as we said, if you add them all up and they're 18% of the population, there's political clout there.
How did the discussion start to happen on a nationwide level of something like the ADA? Did this begin with activism and then sort of get transferred to lawmakers who said, yes, I will stand up in support of this?
Well, you know, first of all, as with so many other identity groups, I mean, the civil rights movement of the 1960s was the template for the way various groups thought about themselves and their involvement with the government. So it was kind of logical that you know, once there was a sense like, hey, we're people with disabilities and we're being oppressed in various ways, that they would look to the civil rights movement for models. And So that's one thing. The other is that the momentum started in kind of whimsical ways. In my book, Enabling Acts, I talk about the sort of, I don't know, the level of whimsy, because when you look back 25 years ago, it seems all but inevitable. But when you're there and looking at it at the moment, the question would be, like, how were people with disabilities going to penetrate the sort of maze of government legislation to get all these different groups on their side and to get the White House on their side? So there are many stories in the book and many people, and I obviously am not going to be able to talk about everybody, but I think there was an interesting kind of confluence. And what happened was there was a group in San Francisco that came out of what was called the Independent Living Movement. And just for your listeners who are not familiar, the Independent Living Movement, which kind of started in Berkeley, was the idea that all these other groups, these larger groups that were run by people without disabilities, were kind of part of the problem. And that independent living meant that you could live independently, that you could have a job, that you had, you know, that you could get up in the morning if you needed a personal assistant, that you would get one. And these groups in the independent living centers were run by people with disabilities who would help other people with disabilities become independent, get funding, get personal assistance if needed, get wheelchairs, etc. And so there's a group that kind of came out of that called DREDIF, which is a disability rights fund. We could talk about that some more if you want to.
All right, we'll come back to that in just a minute. My guest is Leonard J. Davis. He's Distinguished Professor of Liberal Arts in the Departments of Disability Studies and English at the University of Illinois at Chicago. His new book is called Enabling Acts, The Hidden Story of How the Americans with Disabilities Act Gave the Largest U.S. Minority Its Rights. If you'd like to ask a question or maybe share a story about how the ADA has changed your life, give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Leonard J. Davis of the University of Illinois at Chicago about his new book, Enabling Acts, The Hidden Story of How the Americans with Disabilities Act Gave the Largest U.S. Minority Its Rights. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. So, Leonard, you were telling us about this group, DREDIF, which for one thing, framed the fight for access for disabled Americans as a civil rights issue, which was a real switch from the sense in the past that if you were going to do anything for disabled people, it was in a sort of paternalistic way, like taking care of disabled people as opposed to empowering them to take care of themselves.
Yeah, that's right. And that switch was crucial because although we all have rights as American citizens, sometimes those rights are not really enforced, or the, you know, as we saw in 1960s with people who are of color. So moving to the idea of civil rights was much more important than just thinking. I mean, not that rehab isn't important, but it was much more important to visualize and conceptualize this struggle. And what I was telling you before the break was that this group of came from DREDIF, and you could call them Berkeley hippies. They were all lefties. They certainly had the Berkeley imprimatur on them. They decided to go to Washington because the Reagan administration was in the heyday of trying to deregulate and reduce funding and for federal programs, and they were worried that this would affect or negatively impact the independent living movement that I described. So they just basically showed up in Washington on their own, and they crashed in the apartment of a guy whose name was Evan Kemp. And Evan Kemp was working for Ralph Nader and had his own little sort of branch of the Nader's Raiders around the issue of disability. And there's an interesting story about Kemp himself, but I'll save that for the book. So they were crashing on his floor and trying to influence what was going on. Well, it turned out, interestingly, that Evan Kemp was a really good bridge player. And every Thursday night, he played bridge. And one of the people he played bridge with was C. Boyden Gray, who was the legal counsel to then Vice President George Bush. Also, you know, his brother founded the Federalist Society, an extreme conservative. And here's the strange bedfellow part of the story is like how these Berkeley hippies ended up befriending Boyden Gray. And then with that, they had a direct line into the White House because obviously George Bush Sr. became president. And when he became president, Boyden Gray was his right-hand man. So it was a very unusual kind of whimsical thing. And the story of the 8-8 is filled with those kind of strange whimsical, serendipitous moments.
And this caused George H.W. Bush to be particularly, I mean, he was particularly sensitive to the votes he might get from disabled Americans, not least because one of his primary opponents, Bob Dole, was disabled. Bush realized he would have to work hard to let disabled Americans know that he would be an ally for them.
That's right. And the election or the primaries were very, very close. In fact, Bob Dole was ahead of George Bush in Iowa. And when they went to New Hampshire, Dole was in the lead. So it made a lot of sense. And I think Bush was very aware of it, as was Lee Atwater, who was his advisor and who later said he thought that the disability vote probably made the difference in the general election. Bob Dole, by the way, I just saw him the other night. There was a wonderful celebration in the White House of the ADA's 25th anniversary. And he told me an interesting story, which was that, you know, Dole was disabled. He was shot during the war, during World War II, and was severely disabled, made a strong comeback. But it was obvious, and everybody knew that he had a disability. And he said to me that he never played the disability, never talked about it. It wasn't part of what he did. But he felt that actually he lost the lead in the election because another serendipitous moment. They went to New Hampshire, and there was a huge snowstorm. George Bush Sr. was photographed, snow blowing. I'm sure something he did for the first time in his life, but made to seem very masculine. And whereas Dole said he couldn't get out. So all he was doing was, you know, being in a grocery store or saying hello to people. And he felt that that image of Bush Sr., you know, pushing the snowblower and stuff, made the turnaround in that particular primary.
Yeah, I don't know that it was entirely fair of Dole, but he had a great quip that it was normally the kind of thing that the future President George H.W. Bush would tip somebody for, but wouldn't necessarily
That's right.
be riding the snowblower himself.
That's right.
But Bush ultimately was a supporter of this. What was interesting to me was that on Capitol Hill, this measure would really need bipartisan allies. But it seems that many of the champions of the legislation were people who had either experienced disability or had a loved one who did.
That was no coincidence, because one of those Berkeley hippies was a woman named Pat Wright. And she and a number of other people decided that they were going to make sure that everybody involved in the inner core of this legislation, the push for this legislation, were people who either had disabilities or had very close relatives with disabilities. And so, you know, obviously Teddy Kennedy had his sister who was cognitively disabled, had a son who had cancer and had his leg removed. You know, Orrin Hatch had a brother-in-law who had polio. Tom Harkin's brother was deaf. I mean, you could go down the line. Everybody had something. But that also makes sense given the fact that, you know, 20% of the population, let's say, is disabled.
Let's listen here to something that the late Senator Kennedy had to say, I believe, after the measure was passed.
What was absolutely extraordinary to me and what made an indelible impression upon all the members is the community. The disability community came to that hearing in wheelchairs, packed that room at 1:30 or 2 in the morning, and we got the legislation out. And what it said to every member of that committee, and Republican, Democrats alike, is we're serious about this. And we're not going to take no for an answer. And it isn't if we're going to pass it, but when we're going to answer it, pass it. And that created an atmosphere and a climate in terms of not only the committee, but I think in the Senate, that said, this is serious business. We're going to address it.
That was the late Senator Ted Kennedy talking about the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Leonard, when he talks about people showing up at that hearing, is he talking about what's now known as the Capitol crawl?
No, he's talking about something else, which is, by the way, I want to say that the role of activism in this is very important, but it was also very carefully orchestrated. So that, the particular thing he's talking about was, you know, I mean, people didn't just show up on their own. They were obviously, it's also hard to travel with certain kinds of disabilities. So this was very well coordinated. I'm not sure whether this particular one was the one or there were other hearings, but there was a guy named Justin Dart, who's one of the heroes of the disability movement. And he traveled with his wife, Yoshiko, all over the United States several times, collecting disability diaries and listening to people in every state to try to come up with what should go into the ADA. And these disability diaries, one of the things they did, which was deliberately planned, was to take, you know, cases and cases of them, bring them into the hearing room and dump them out. I think Pat Wright said that the movie about Santa Claus, I'm blanking, Miracle on 34th mm-hmm. Street has that moment where all the letters get dumped out in the courtroom. So they actually very consciously remade that moment with all these disability diaries to show the strength and the number of people who, you know, who were watching.
It's astonishing to think that we spent so much time in the United States and public buildings were not accessible to people with physical disabilities.
You know, it's, yes. And a lot of the kind of, one of the pleasures, I think, in some ways of the 25th anniversary is looking back. And when you look back and you think, how was it possible that federal buildings with taxpayer money would be inaccessible? And it's sort of like the same thing when we look back and how was it that Americans, you know, many Americans agreed with slavery? I mean, I'm sure there are many people who were good people in a lot of other ways who were just who saw it as part of the natural landscape. And the same thing, one of the things that amazes me is And when they were trying to pass the law, there was, as you can imagine, at the time, there was a lot of pushback and a lot of objections to, you know, especially, for example, on transportation, with the idea of the bus companies and the municipalities would say, you want us to put a wheelchair lift on every bus? Do you imagine how much money that will cost? That will bankrupt us. But when you look around and you see that in virtually every American town, on every corner, there are 4 curb cuts. I mean, can you imagine proposing that in the past? And people would obviously say, like, there is no way we could do that. How are you going to put curb cuts on every single... But when you look back on it, you see how the built environment discriminated against people. And it's so obvious to us now. And I don't know if you were going to touch on this later, but I just want to bring up the issue of the internet, because if you want to know why it was that people didn't notice, ask people about the internet and is it accessible? I mean, most people have no idea, just the way they hadn't paid any attention to curb cuts or wheelchair lifts. But the internet is inaccessible to blind people and to deaf people and to people with learning disabilities. And most websites, and I wonder if yours at KERA, if you've checked, to see whether your website is accessible. I mean, those are the kind of things that they're hidden from you because the discrimination is invisible. And only when later on, when you look back, you say, oh, it was so obvious that that discrimination was there.
It is interesting to think about the fact that there are technologies that on the one hand make life easier and on the other hand require only a relatively simple adaptation. My understanding is the code that would allow a website to be sort of read off aloud to someone with a visual disability is out there. Like, you can purchase that and add that to a website, but there's no not necessarily motivation for people to adapt their online presence this way?
Sure, absolutely. And it's not a big deal. I mean, you know, and there are websites that you can run your website through that will tell you whether your website is accessible or not. When you say there's no motivation, if people are educated, there will be motivation. A very simple example. Are you a Facebook user?
Yes.
Okay, so am I. So then, you know, somebody puts up something on Facebook, you love it, you forward it, post it. Usually there's a picture. Every time you do that, a blind person is not able to see the picture. All you have to do is type in photo description, man standing with placard, and you have ended a kind of discrimination that you were unaware of. I mean, if most people understood this, how long does it take to describe a photograph? But people don't do it because they don't know that it's a form of discrimination.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Trish in Fort Worth. Hi, Trish.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
I'm really enjoying the show as a family with various disabilities. And I just had a question. What suggestions do you have for people with, I guess, mini activisms that we could do to help in some small way, even if we don't know anyone that's disabled? For listeners that might not have ever thought about this before, I was just thinking maybe like architecture schools could actively invite the disabled to come into the schools to help the students learn to think about design in a different perspective. Something like that that we could each do in our lives to make changes for everyone and have a more inclusive society.
Thanks for your call.
I think that's a great idea. I mean, I think the biggest thing, and it's this is a form of discrimination that an ADA can't deal with, which is that, you know, there's the legal legislation and then there's the social discrimination. And for all of us, we meet people with disabilities all the time. There are people. I mean, the point is we subtly discriminate against people subtly and not so subtly. It would be good for all of us to individually, I guess, try to learn more about the disability, welcome people in rather than exclude them. I mean, it's a complicated issue because, you know, there are the things that we can do individually, but a lot of this is a larger issue. for example, we don't have very good images of people with disability out there in the world. You know, we have certain like if you think about TV, television and movies, there are very few movies and television shows in which a person with a disability is just there. You know, in other words, either the show is going to be about their disability and that's going to be the whole thing, and then the story will be either them overcoming it or, you know. So, but I mean, I use the example of pregnancy. I mean, you know, if someone's pregnant in the real world, it doesn't mean anything. They're pregnant. That's good. but suddenly, the only time you see pregnant people on TV, pregnant women on TV, is if it's part of the story. And the same thing is true with people with disabilities. The only time you see them is if it's part of the story. Whereas in real life, people are just there. 20% of the population is there. Their disability doesn't signify anything. It isn't part of a larger story. It doesn't have to be dressed up to say, and this is a story of how someone triumphed over their disability. I think that's going to take a bit of working with Hollywood to do better. The other part about that is that it's very few actors with disabilities are on the scene. Most years the Academy Award is given to a film about someone with a disability, as it was this year with Stephen Hawking's movie. But the actor is always a person, or virtually always a person, who has no disability. So it's sort of like the equivalent in the old days of blackface, you know, where people would put blackface on and play the role. But why not have? There are so many talented actors out there with disabilities. Why not get them to play the roles? And that way, the more we saw people with disabilities on TV and in films, we would get more comfortable with the idea that it isn't an us-them thing. It's all part of human diversity.
Can't speak to Hollywood so much, but I would point out that Texas, of course, has a disabled governor, and it really doesn't come up very often. I think in the coverage of him, it's really not so much about his disability, it's about him functioning as our governor.
Which is a good thing.
Yeah. Actually, we need to take a quick break here. We will take more stories from you, more questions from you at 1-800-933-5372. In just a minute, we'll continue our conversation with my guest, Leonard J. Davis, Distinguished Professor of Liberal Arts in the Departments of Disability Studies and English at the University of Illinois at Chicago. His new book is called Enabling Acts, The Hidden Story of How the Americans with Disabilities Act Gave the Largest U.S. Minority Its Rights. You can be part of the conversation, as we said, online. You can also make a comment on Twitter. I'm at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Our success with this act proves that we are keeping faith with the spirit of our courageous forefathers who wrote in the Declaration of Independence, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights." And these words have been our guide for more than two centuries as we've labored to form our more perfect union. But tragically, for too many Americans, the blessings of liberty have been limited or even denied. And the Civil Rights Act of 64 took a bold step towards righting that wrong, but the stark fact remained that people with disabilities were still victims of segregation and discrimination, and this was intolerable. And today's legislation brings us closer to that day when no Americans will ever again be deprived of their basic guarantee of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
You're listening to Think on KERA. That was President George H.W. Bush speaking at the signing ceremony for the Americans with Disabilities Act 25 years ago this week. We're discussing that history with my guest, Leonard J. Davis, author of Enabling Acts, The Hidden Story of How the Americans with Disabilities Act Gave the Largest U.S. Minority Its Rights. He would go on to say in that same address, Leonard, that the ADA made the U.S. the international leader in civil rights for people with disabilities. Is that in fact the case?
Yeah, well, it is in the sense that the act was the template for legislation around the world. It was the most far-ranging piece of civil rights legislation, I would say, ever made. And so I think it is true. Where we are in terms of being compared to the rest of the world, one thing which has come up and has been a very disappointing series of events is that the ADA led to the UN making a treaty on disability rights. And almost every country in the world has signed it, but and ratified it. But the United States has signed it, but it didn't ratify it. And the last 2 years, it's been brought up before the Senate and has been shot down. Hmm. That's a sort of complicated little piece of political skullduggery in a way, because and by the way, Bob Dole got out of the hospital, out of Walter Reed Hospital, and came to the floor of the Senate to ask that the legislation be passed, or that it be ratified. And this takes us to something we haven't really discussed, which is that even though there was unanimity on and passage in some sense, that this was a bipartisan bill and probably one that would not be passed today. I mean, that's at least what all the politicians I spoke to said. But there were real political differences between the left and the right in this bill. And the bill is a compromise bill. Because, as you can imagine, if you're covering so many parts of the United States, transportation, communications, employment, public accommodations, private accommodations, all of those things involve a lot of interests and a lot of people. And basically, the Republicans wanted to make sure that the bill was business friendly, and the liberals wanted to make sure that it was people friendly. And those two things can often come in conflict with each other. So in this particular case of the treaty, one of the reasons it's not getting passed is because conservative Republicans are very suspicious of UN treaties in general and see them as potentially limiting the ability of the United States to have its own laws. That's completely not true in terms of this treaty, but that's the way it's being perceived.
Not least among areas of compromise in the domestic legislation was this question of what specific disabilities would qualify individuals for protection under this law.
Yeah. the definition that the original that the act had was is a little complicated. I don't want to go into it here, but it was a very broad definition and kind of counterintuitive in a certain way. And it included a lot of disabilities, but conservative senators like Jesse Helms were very disturbed by whom it might include. So, for example, Helms got on the floor of the Senate and he just went through a whole list. Are you saying that pedophiles are people with disabilities? Are you saying that transgender people would be covered under this act? What about alcoholics? What about drug addicts? And he tried to hold up the bill on this particular issue of who would be included and who wouldn't. The bill ended up carving out, literally saying it doesn't include a lot of the sexual perversions, as he called them, and issues around, for example, alcoholism and addiction. That was part of the compromise.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Lisa in Fort Worth. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. I was just wanted to say the act basically saved my daughter's life as far as she has dyslexia, dysgraphia, and ADD. And because of the act, we were able to get her an IEP, an individual education plan, when she was very young, and had accommodations put in place that allowed her to thrive and to eventually become the president of her class from ninth grade through 12th grade at her high school in Mansfield High, and just completed her first year of college and has a 3.8 GPA. So it's, you know, otherwise she would have just been swept under the carpet, I believe, because, you know, kids that can't read or can't, you know, or fall behind, and it just made her be able to thrive and become successful, and she's pursuing a degree in leadership at Texas A&M. So,
well, congratulations, Lisa. Give her our best. That's something certainly to be proud of. I appreciate your call. And Leonard, it takes us to a great place to talk about the way that the ADA has helped change education and the way we approach it.
Yeah, I think, and it's a wonderful story, and it's reduplicated, you know, thousandfold across the country. I mean, I was just running in upstate New York, and the local farmer and I just stopped and started talking. He has a son who is autistic, and he was having a lot of trouble with the local school. He was able to file a complaint with the Department of Education, and now the son is the school has been reprimanded. The son has been transferred to another school and is doing extremely well. And he's a very sensitive poet and actor. And, you know, in the past, people like that and like your caller's daughter would have been considered stupid, bad students, would have been penalized within the education system and would have had no chance to go ahead. And we're seeing now, I mean, I think the act initially covered a lot or thought of disability as a physical thing, although mental issues are there. But now more and more, we have, you know, people who are neurologically diverse, neurodiversity, as they call it, autistic people, people with different learning styles, people who have trouble reading but can hear and learn that way. So those people now can have a chance to, you know, get ahead, get an education. That was impossible in the past. So the ADA has accomplished a lot. A lot of people are, you know, able to get out, get to work. People who are institutionalized are now not institutionalized. There's been rulings based on the ADA that says that people who have to be kept put in or can progress to the least restrictive environment. So there are stories of people who are institutionalized, you know, who are in terrible states of mind and body and emotion, who got out and have become artists and poets. And so the gain has been tremendous.
Many people will argue, many people have stories of the fact that the ADA is not perfect. The ADA certainly has not solved every access challenge for people who otherwise could live independent, empowered lives.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very wide-ranging act. It covers a lot of people. Is it a success in all areas? Obviously not. The biggest area that it's not a success in is in the area of employment. 80% of people with disabilities are unemployed, 80%, which is a huge number. You know, because the act is an anti-discrimination act, because it was an anti-discrimination act, it doesn't create jobs. It doesn't create a situation where employers want to hire people with disabilities. All it says is you can't discriminate against someone who's otherwise qualified but who has a disability. But the only way the law works is that you have to bring a lawsuit or you have to file a complaint with the Department of Education, Department of Justice, or the Equal Opportunities Commission, Equal Employment Opportunities Commission. So it's only activated by an individual person saying, like, wow, that's not right, and I'm going to prove that person, you know, did some kind of discrimination to me. There's no Bureau of Disability. There's no Department of Disability. There's no enforcement agency on its own. And there's no necessary reason for employers to hire people with disabilities. That's the problem, and that needs to be fixed, for one thing.
And, of course, there's a disincentive for some people with disabilities who choose not to define their identity according to their disability to file one of those lawsuits if they have been discriminated
against.
That's right.
And people are afraid, you know, and justly so, that if they file a lawsuit, they'll be in worse shape with their employer. So that is a problem. Another disincentive is that, you know, there are two kinds of disability benefits. There are benefits for people who are poor and have never really worked, and there are benefits for people who have worked. For people who are poor and haven't really worked very much, there's something called SSI, and that gets you very little money. You get about $9,000 a year to live on, which is pretty staggering. I mean, a person with a disability is twice as likely as a non-disabled person to make $11,000 or less, just to put that in the hopper. But if such a person who's receiving SSI wants to go to work, the first thing that will happen is they'll immediately lose their disability benefits, and they might even lose services. So, for example, if in order to get out of bed in the morning, if you need a personal assistant and you decide you want to go to work, you will lose the personal assistant who helps you get out of bed to go to work. The second thing is, if you decide to marry, we just see now that there's, you know, gay marriage. People with disabilities who are on such benefits can't marry, because if you marry, you'll lose the benefits if the person you're marrying has a job or even has assets more than $2,000. So there's like huge disincentives to go to work. And for people, that needs to be adjusted. People need to be able to know that they can keep their benefits, or they can keep their health insurance and their home assistance, and be able to work.
We're getting close to the end here. I want to take one final quick call from Lisa in Dallas. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. I hope you can hear me.
We can.
I just wanted to point out, I work as an advocate for people with disabilities, and I noticed in the program you referred to disabled people, and we're always taught to put the disability after the person, put the person first in our language, and refer to them as children with autism instead of autistic children, or people with cognitive impairments instead of cognitively impaired people.
I'm glad you brought that up, and I really appreciate the correction. Leonard, I appreciate your patience if you heard me use the term incorrectly.
I actually want to say something about that. The people first language is something that I think came about in the 80s, not just with disabilities, but many other people of color. The whole idea was you're a person first, and then you're your whatever afterwards. But I think there's a group, a younger group of people who are comfortable saying disabled person, and who are part of a kind of disability pride movement where, you know, they'll, you know, just like people said, you know, black and proud. The people say I'm disabled, and I'm proud of it. That is my identity. So I don't think it's a settled issue. I think it's a generational one.
Are people on Capitol Hill still paying attention to the ways that the ADA may need to continue to be amended to really serve the functions for which it was enacted?
Well, there was a big Amendments Act in 2008 that redefined disability because there were a lot of lawsuits that were coming up that were basically, I think, doing kind of crazy interpretations, because the original definition, as I talk about in my book, Enabling Acts, is a complicated one. And that Amendments Act seems to have cleared up some things. There's still legislation on Capitol Hill, I mean, because the issue is not solved. One piece of legislation that's going through right now is about sheltered workshops. So, you know, some people with disabilities work in sheltered workshops, like for Goodwill, for example. And they're paid 22 cents an hour, some of them. And that's because this is a law from the 1930s, when they were trying to reintegrate people from World War I. And the idea is that if you're a person with a disability, you should be able to get minimum wage, not 22 cents an hour. And that bill is working its way through. There are other bills as well, and there's also executive orders by the president. Most recently, a couple of years ago, President Obama made an executive order that the federal government needed to hire more people with disabilities. And the federal government's doing really well in terms of the number of people with disabilities who are working there.
The new book by Leonard J. Davis is called Enabling Acts: The Hidden Story of How the Americans with Disabilities Act Gave the Largest U.S. Minority Its Rights. Leonard, thank you so much for making this time for us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.